Welcome, welcome, welcome. This is the Distraction Pieces podcast, episode 494, and it's the first guest episode of 2023. And I've had this one locked in place for a minute because I got the chance to talk to one of my favourite actors, and they turned out to be one of my favourite people. And we had such a good chat. We talk acting, we talk just life, we talk balance, and we talk disability and kind of mental health when campaigning. We talk a lot of stuff. I'm joined today by Ruth Madeley, who proper blew me away in years and years and has just done so much good stuff. I'm such a fan. Has announced some amazingly exciting things recently as well since we had this conversation. But yeah, you're going to be seeing a lot more of Ruth, and rightfully so. But I kind of realised we needed to have a podcast chat off the back of some of the disability campaigning that Ruth was doing and the disability campaigning I was doing with Stammer, because Stammer is the British Stammering Association. And there's been a big thing recently because it feels like, because of people like Ruth, we're starting to make ground on getting more disability representation and awareness in TV and film. But Stammers really feel like something that's being left behind. So we get into all of that, basically. I won't bore you with it now. We're going to have a genuinely engaging and not a conversation that isn't going to make anyone feel guilty for being able-bodied or for being able to speak fluently. It's not that kind of conversation. This is just, yeah, it's lovely. As ever, we're brought to you by speechdevelopmentrecords.com. That's where you can get all my merch. Patreon.com/ScroobiusPip is where you can support the podcast for $1 a month. And twitch.tv/ScroobiusPipYo is where you can keep up on all the mad things I'm doing of late. If you're not a fan of gaming, I recommend you go over to my Twitch and watch in the collections or in the highlights or something. You go to videos and collections. Either watch the A Twitchmas Carol or the Blair Twitch Project, because they're basically little films. So yeah, give them a look. They're free. It's all free. Yeah, I want to tell you now as well, I've got a bonus episode coming out on Friday because I wanted to give you a double hit of goodness. It's with the amazing Lenny Rush, who really jumped to people's attention in Am I Being Unreasonable on the BBC. Lenny's 12 and we talk for about 30, 40 minutes, and he's one of the most considerate, articulate kids or people I've had on the podcast. Lenny is also doing a lot for disability awareness through kind of campaigning and interviews, but also just through the amazing work he's doing. So yeah, we've got a really cool double whammy of guests to start the year off. We've got loads more good stuff to come, so I'll tell you more about that soon enough. But for now, this is episode 494 of the Distraction Pieces podcast with the wonderful Ruth Madeley. And then we're good to go. We're going. I'm here today with Ruth Madeley. How are you?
I'm great. How are you?
I'm really good. It's really weird on these because kind of the more excited I am to talk to someone I've not met before, almost the more rude I seem at first, because I'm quite straight away. Have you got headphones? Let's get recording, because I want to get it all on the podcast, you know?
I'm all for it. I do apologise in advance because my dog has just come in from his walk and he wants to be involved, clearly.
What is your dog's name? What kind of dog?
He's a British bulldog and he's called Boo.
Love it.
Yes, you want to be involved, don't you? So if he lies down snoring, that's what that noise is.
That's absolutely fine. Well, to kick things off, like, how are you? How are you at the moment? Again, it's such a cliche, but that question seems to have added so much weight post-pandemic because I mean, not to get too heavy, but under a Tory government, under all these different things, it's a genuine question. How are you? How are you in yourself? Are you well?
You know what? I'm all right. There's been a few points this year where it's been touch and go, I'm not going to lie. Yeah. But I think what helps is me putting the Christmas tree up. That has really helped.
love it.
Proper Buddy the Elf over here. That's me. So, no, I am feeling very good.
I've got a big confession here. I just went over to the corner. There's a corner of my room I don't go into that much, okay?
Right.
And it's where I put the Christmas tree normally. And I was just over there moving a few things around. And I saw some pines on the floor from last year's Christmas tree.
I wouldn't worry. We're still picking bits up from last year as well.
It's perfectly timed now because I can just put the new one up and it's all, I can clean it up in January. But yeah, I looked and went, oh man, they're going to have new ones.
It's all good. It's all good.
Well, before we get into all of the big conversation, there's loads I want to talk to you about, but I really want to talk to you about Home Alone Lego. How's that coming along? I saw you post about this. I'm really annoyed. I almost had Lego sponsor me a few months back and I was like, look, can you send me some stuff? And they went with another podcast instead because I've never got into grown-up Lego as such, but there's loads of good shit. I go in the Lego store in London when I'm up there. It's amazing.
Honestly, I have looked at this Home Alone house for years. I own no other Lego, literally nothing. And I've been so excited about this Home Alone house for years. And then me and the other half were in America a couple of months back. And I saw the Home Alone house in real life and it was all lit up and it was perfect.
Wow.
So I was like, I don't care. That is what I'm getting. I'm actually buying it. And I did. And it's, to be fair, it probably isn't the Christmas tree that's made me feel a lot better about life. It's probably the Home Alone house. We've built the bottom, the ground floor is looking very nice now. Honestly, I'm beyond obsessed with it. The plan was that it would be mine and Joe's new Christmas tradition. We'd get it out at the beginning of December and we'd build it every Christmas. Once this is built, it will take so much for me to break that up and put it in the loft. I think it might just have to stay there for the entire year.
Yeah, the tradition will be buying all the other houses on the street.
This is the problem. I feel like I've started something that I won't be able to control now. But no, it is the best thing I have ever bought.
Genuinely, I think the reason I've not bought any is that exact worry that you've expressed there. It's like, I won't be able to stop because there's been a few different like film cars I've looked at, a few different buildings, all that kind of thing.
See,
and I'm like,
this is it. Man, well, Joel's already talking now. He wants the Back to the Future DeLorean. He wants everything now. So I think I've created a monster.
I love it. I'm excited to see the rest unfold. Well, there's loads I want to talk to you about. As I've touched upon in our messages, I'm a big fan.
Oh, well, the feeling is mutual.
I love it. So I definitely want to talk about years and years. I want to talk about the accident. I want to talk about Fresh Meat, Save Me. We probably won't get through all of it. But one of the things that made me find you on Instagram, and it feels like a good topic to start with, I've just been doing a lot of campaigning with Stammer, the British Stammering Association, about the representation of the stammering in TV and film, because it really feels like there's loads of areas that really need improving, but stammering almost feels like the one that's left behind in a lot of the movements. Like it's not really added on to anything else. So I wanted to talk a little bit about your work for disability representation and kind of, I guess, can you tell me your story? Because your work for disability representation starts as a child and continues now. So kind of, can you fill me and the listeners in?
Sure. So I was born with my disability. I've got spina bifida. And that developed into scoliosis, which is curvature of the spine. So I've used a wheelchair pretty much all my life. I'm an ambulatory wheelchair user, so I can walk a few steps as well. And I grew up knowing that I never saw anyone who looked like me on TV. I was always very aware of that. I went to a mainstream school where there was no other kids who were in wheelchairs at primary school. And so I've always known that I was different, but I've been very privileged to have grown up in an environment where that wasn't seen as a negative thing on the whole. Yeah. It was, and I've always had really strong friendship groups. But I think the reason that I'd become, quite immersed in the importance of representation is because at age 5, the children's charity WizKids bought me my first wheelchair. It was bespoke. Yeah. It was bright pink. I looked like Barbie. It was heaven. And I saw from very young age what having the right mobility equipment could, how that could dramatically improve my life, my friendship groups, because I was able to participate in more things because I had the freedom to move. And so I became really involved with WizKids and a lot of the stuff, their services for children. And then I volunteered as a young adult and I ended up being employed by them. So that was my first full-time job.
It's such an important area and thing to talk about and address, because it's realizing that, as so many things in our society, we touched upon it briefly earlier, class comes into it, and wealth, and you know, accessibility to accessibility, if you know
That's
what I mean.
The so thing.
It's so weird that there's these things that Absolutely. You clearly need and will change your life, but unless you can afford it, you're getting the basics or whatever else. I've got a friend who came on the podcast, Angel Jufria, who's got an amazing robotic arm. And they had a terrible situation recently, a few years back. And I won't go into it in huge detail, but the company who had provided it to her had changed ownership and asked for it back. And it was like,
oh,
this
God.
Young woman, this has been her arm for 4 or 5 years. This is, it's literally a part of her. And she had to go through the process of packing her arm up and posting it back because it's so expensive and she couldn't afford it. And she got some kind of leniency on it because she was a representative, a campaigner, an influencer, all these kinds of things. But at some point, the fact that someone could turn around and say, you've got to give your arm back because you don't have the wealth to have.
I know.
It's horrific.
I mean,
stuff like that just it blows my mind.
It does. I'm just as a sidebar, I adore Angel. I think she's fantastic.
Yeah.
But in the same way, like when my dad and my mum first heard about WizKids, and when they saw this Barbie pink wheelchair at some kind of mobility kind of roadshow thing, and my dad was fully, he was like, well, then I'm clearly going to sell my kidney on the black market to be able to afford this. Yeah. This is what we're going to do, because we weren't in a position to be able to afford this. And that's when we heard about of WizKids, because without that charity, there was no way we'd be, mobility equipment is so expensive that there was just no way that we would, I was in a really heavy, didn't fit me properly chair from the NHS at the time, because that was what was on offer. So it is really important to recognise that if you're disabled, if you have money, you can live a lot better, which is terrifying and so wrong.
Yeah, it really is. And I guess, how have you seen, as I said, from being working with them from an early age as well, how have you seen things change societally? Because again, the big misrepresentation is that a disability restricts you from interacting with things. And it's not that. It's the way those things are put together. It's the accessibility to those things that restrict you. A wheelchair allows you to access these things. It's the stairs that cause the problem, or it's this or that.
Absolutely.
Or, you know, all these other things. So, but it does feel as if kind of in your lifetime, I guess, it has become a lot more of a focus when new buildings are being built and things like this. It becomes more of a focus on making sure accessibility is taken into account. Even gigs and touring, I always remember that kind of being a change when I was doing my music, that I'd realise so many early days gigs are in like a room above a pub, and it's a grotty old pub. And we had to kind of go, right, well, how can anyone who has a disability that wants to attend get here? And if they can't, then we need to look at something else. Yeah, we need to look at other options and things like that. And I think that was, it has been a change. Obviously, it's not a finished job.
I'm very much about celebrating every little victory. And I do think that I've seen huge changes in a lot of areas in my lifetime. I've also seen some things stop and some things get worse. And I do think that we've got a really good foundation of change being able to happen. And I think conversations are being had a lot more now and things are being spoken about a lot more. Sadly, I don't think, I mean, I'm one of my biggest flaws is I'm super impatient. So I will never think that things are happening quick enough.
I will never
think that things are happening quick enough. But I do think that we're a lot further than we were last year. And next year will hopefully be further than we are now. So yeah, I do think there is still so much to be done, but there is massive differences that I've seen, especially in the terms of representation since I was a child and knowing that I didn't see anyone who looked like me on screen. But yeah, we're nowhere near where we need to be, but we are on the way. And I think that's the best way to put it.
I completely agree. And as weird as it sounds, this is the stupidest sentence that you're going to hear.
I'm excited.
This week. One of the keys to representation is representation. And let me explain that a bit more, right? Because it has to be shown that this needs to become the norm, not just a one-off action or statement. And I know from working with Stammer that on Stammering Awareness Day, I'm asked on the news, I'm asked on the radio, I'm asked in all these places for Stammering Awareness Day, and we talk about all the positive change that needs to be done. And then the next day, we've moved on to something else. And it's like, no, that's not...
But this is the point.
That's what it's about.
Well, on the 3rd of December, it was International Disability Day. And I saw the best tweet ever from one of my idols, Liz Carr, who is just the most phenomenal woman and disability advocate and actress, everything that you can imagine. And she said, International Day of Disability is purely for us, for disabled people. It is not for people or businesses to feel good about themselves because they have a ramp. And I just thought that was the best thing, because it really does get frustrating when you see, I mean, it's the same with everything, not just disability. You see, oh, we'll have a day to champion this, but what about all the other days of the year when you're doing absolutely nothing? You can't just have it for one day and say, oh, aren't we great because we've done this, 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 and this today. It's not about doing the bare minimum to make yourself look good. It's about changing institutional issues, that the stuff at the very bottom, and rebuild everything. And yeah, so I completely get what you mean about it being one day and aren't we great.
And again, I get you as well on who these things are for, because I find that to be a really interesting conversation as well, because I've only just kind of come to some realizations on that myself. Like with stammering in particular, it's something as an example, you're aware of disability. You're quite aware of it. You don't really need that much extra awareness. You know what's going on. Same with me. With my stammer, but the realization I had was that so 1-2% of adults in the UK stammer, right? And the representation is appalling. Like in a recent YouGov survey, I think it was like 59% of people couldn't name a single character who stammers. Only 2% could name 5. And in the top 5 people named were Forrest Gump and Rain Man, who don't have stammers, which was amazing. But the big thing that I was talking about a lot on International Stammering Awareness Day was for people who stammer, the awareness isn't only for that 1-2%. It's for the 98-99% who don't have stammers but don't encounter them, because a stammer is something that is massively misunderstood and people don't know how to act. You'll have it constantly being a wheelchair user, people crouching down or putting an arm on, do you know what I mean? Being really, like, again, you don't have to do any of that. And the awareness is about making everyone aware and making them not feel awkward. Like, I'm not having a go at anyone here. I completely understand that when someone I don't know is talking to me and I'm stammering a lot, they're going to panic. They're going to think, oh, how can I help?
Let me help.
What can I do? Shall I finish the sentence? Shall I try and relax you? And people don't realise, again, I talked about this on a recent episode. People often assume, I had a few messages a year or two into my podcast from people saying, is everything all right? Because you're stammering more on the podcast. And I was like, right, what you don't understand is I'm stammering more because I'm more relaxed. Mm-hmm. I'm not hiding it anymore. I spent years of my career hiding
Absolutely.
It. So the fact I'm stammering more isn't that I'm having a stressful time in life. And I'm like, and the assumption is you're nervous if you're stammering. It's like, no, I feel relaxed with you lot now. That's a nice thing. You know, it should be a positive. But that's kind of one of my big realizations on awareness and representation, is the more kids see people in wheelchairs, that it's not a key part of their character. It's not their main thing. It's not their main struggle. And you've played some characters that epitomize that, where it's not, oh, here's the wheelchair character. It's no, this character happens to have a wheelchair. Here's the mum. Here we are again. So we had a bit of a technical issue there, and we both kind of went into slow motion, and I could see you moving slowly.
I could see the same with you. It sounded really robotic. And then it was underwater. And then, anyway, here we are.
Well, but Basically, I was yammering on about representation. You were yammering on about representation, as we do. But before we wind that up, can you tell me about some of your more recent kind of campaigns and speeches and events and stuff like that?
Sure. So I think the most recent was at BAFTA, sponsored by Disney and ITV. And it was called About Time. And it was looking at the importance of telling disabled stories, but how, not just telling them, but how they're told, and that they should be told authentically and not in a stereotypical way. And of course, they should be told by disabled people. So that was really, really exciting to, it was my first hosting as well, which was very fun and scary. Yeah. And I think I made it 4 minutes without swearing. I dropped the F-bomb within like the first four fucking minutes. And it was, so that broke the ice in the room. So that was quite nice in front of a lot of Disney execs. Yeah. Great. But so that was a really great way to allow disabled people to show how their stories, how they want their stories to be told. Yeah. It felt a bit, those things always feel quite weird at first, because it feels like you having to kind of beg for roles, you know, stand up there and show people that you're actually good at what you do. But it didn't feel like that at the same time. It was more of a, because one of the biggest things that annoys me and other disabled people as well, and as I'm sure you'll feel the same, is whenever we talk about representation, the importance of it, all the execs at the top of this tree sit there and go, well, where do we find these actors? Where do we find these people? There just aren't any. How fucking lazy is that? And it's just so boring when you hear that. And we just wanted to kind of shine a light on the fact that you find disabled talent the exact same way you'd find non-disabled talent. Mm-hmm. You go and you put the work in and you look in the right places.
And it's key to why representation isn't just about, here's the film about the girl in the wheelchair. It's about, because again, I completely understand when people will argue, well, we need a big Hollywood A-lister in the lead. It's like, I get that, but that name wasn't always a name.
It's what comes first.
They came up playing small roles.
Exactly.
So again, that's what we need. The more, supporting characters who have disabilities, things like that, then you build these actors who are then the big, the big name.
That's the thing. How can anybody become a big name if they're not given the work to become the big name? It blows my mind that people, some people still argue that is the right way to do things. I'm like, no, for crying out loud. This is the thing. Disabled people can lead stories. Disabled people can lead stories that are not just about disability, but that have a disability as an incidental part of the character. Like you said, the more we have, the hopefully fewer and far between those conversations, those boring, tired, old conversations are going to become.
I am going to move on from the campaigning, but one of the things I wanted to ask you, because again, I've loved so much of the work you've done.
Thank you.
On screen and off screen. I wanted to ask you how the campaigning side of things, how you find it mentally, because I've realised since becoming more of a campaigner in this area that I have to really keep an eye on my mental health during these things, because I have real ups and downs, because I sometimes don't want to feel like I'm defined by having a stammer. And when I'm campaigning, obviously I have to be. That's kind of part of it. But if I've been doing a load of campaigns for a while, I'll then start to think, well, I don't want to be the stammering actor. And again, similarly, you should be up for roles that don't have a wheelchair in the script. You're an actor. It should be a secondary thing. How do you find that balance? Because it's, as I said, it's a weird thing that I've found in recent years that I need to, the people at Stammer are amazing, but I've had to talk to them and say, look, at points I need time off because I don't want to feel like, again, as you say, feel like that my campaigning is me begging for my work for me. It's not. It's about representation.
Absolutely.
But I happen to also be an actor. So.
You know what? I'll be honest, I find it really, really hard, and I have done from this. Yeah. And I would say, as much as I have always had a passion for it and always been involved in it, I was kind of reluctant when I came in the industry to become the spokesperson for it, for disability, and become the person who everybody went to ask about disability. Because One, because I, like you said, I didn't want to be seen that that's all I could do and that's all I was good for. But also, when you're one of the few that are getting the bigger roles, as you know, mm-hmm. it's really hard. I'm an expert in my own disability. I am not an expert in anybody else's. And I get things wrong all the time. I get things wrong. I'm learning all the time, just like everybody else. Whereas I think if you're seen as that spokesperson, I worry that I will not represent people properly because I can't represent everybody. Because I'm not an expert. I'm not a disability consultant. I am just somebody who has a lived experience of spina bifida and scoliosis and of being a wheelchair user. That is my experience. But then I think as my career went on, I realized that I, as much as on the days when I don't, sometimes it's exhausting being the teacher. You can never just go to work and do your job. You have to be the teacher. You have to educate. Whether you want to or not, that's just what you have to do because there are not enough of us working in the industry to make it, you know, ordinary. But then I realized that I'm in a very privileged position where I'm working constantly. I'm working a lot. So whether I like it or not, I do it because I want to make it easier for the people coming in after me. That's not to say it's easy because it really isn't. Some days I find it easier than others. Yeah, some days I'm like, yeah, let's campaign. I want to set the world on fire. I want to change everything, you know, make this the whole world. Because if it's more accessible for us, it's more accessible for everybody. Accessibility benefits everyone. Yeah. But then you do have some days where I just want to say my fucking lines and go home.
I just want to make a film. Exactly that. I just want to do the art. Yeah,
and it's really, some days are a lot easier than others. But I think, I understand I do have to watch it and I can't. And I think in lockdown, I became a lot more kind of campaigny, especially on social media. I did become a lot more, consuming a lot more information because, you know, we weren't working. And it did kind of get to me a little bit. So I do have to watch, definitely. I get what you mean. And so it's about finding a balance and knowing and realising and accepting that it's not just my responsibility, just like it's just not your responsibility. It's everybody has to change things as a collective. And I sometimes have to check myself and remember, you know, you can't do all this on your own and you shouldn't have to.
It's not all on you. Yeah, completely. But that's the industry that we're in, isn't it?
Oh my God,
We're bred to think, why aren't I getting that role? Why, if I'm not a superstar yet,
I'm not doing enough. I'm not doing enough. Something that I always have to really watch myself, because I say that to myself a little bit too much.
Yeah, I feel you. So what was your route into acting? As a kid, was acting always what you wanted to do, or was it just when did it happen? What did you want to do originally?
Mate, it was a complete accident. I'm not joking. My career is an accident. No, it was, I've always loved storytelling. Storytelling was something I've always been fascinated in. And my first ever award at primary school was for writing. I loved writing. I loved reading, storytelling, characters, everything like that. So, and then knowing that I never saw anyone who looked like me on screen, I knew I wanted to be part of changing disability representation in the media. And I studied script writing at university. So I thought that I always knew I wanted to be in the industry, but I never thought in front of camera was my place.
Right.
And I don't know whether that was because it's almost like I didn't ever think it was an option. I didn't even think about it. But at the same time, it wasn't something where I looked at it and thought, oh, I can't do that. It wasn't even on my radar. It was not on my radar at all. So I was doing some work experience at BBC and I met a producer when I was, I think I'd just come out of university and I was just doing some work experience at BBC in the script editing team, I think, or something like that. And I met a producer that said, oh, they need a wheelchair user for a CBBC drama that they're putting on. Do you want to just go just because you're here? Any wheelchair user will do. And
I was going to say, that really steers into the, how do we find these actors? It's like, just look around, I guess. Just pick the first person you see.
Honestly, it was hysterical. It's like, you're here, you go. And I went purely to be nosy. I just thought, oh, great, I'm going to meet another director. I'm going to meet another producer. I'm going to go and expand my contacts.
Yeah.
I just thought it was a networking opportunity. It's terrible. And I went in and I did the audition. I remember thinking, actors are insane. Why would they willingly put themselves through this? I'm terrified. What on earth is wrong with these people? Why would you do this to yourself willingly all the time? But then you got the adrenaline rush, you see.
Yeah.
And I was like, oh, yeah. And then I got the job. I don't know how much that says about my acting ability or how terrible everybody else was. I'm not sure. But I got it.
Or how lazy the casting was. If this one producer was just like...
She's here. Why down. Not? But when I fell in love with it was when I worked on set.
Mm.
That was when I got the real buzz for it. And I just thought, I want to do this again. I want to do it. But at the same time, as much as I wanted to do it again, I never envisaged it being my full-time job. I didn't think it was a sustainable way to make a living.
Yeah.
I just thought it would be something that I could do on the side and keep building contacts while I work for WizKids, because I was working at WizKids full-time as well.
Right.
So
yeah.
I genuinely saw it as something fun to do on the side. And I got a small role in Fresh Meat, which was great.
Again, amazing series. And that's a series that me and my partner have been rewatching it recently. And it is a pool of talent. Like, I saw Nicole Leckie in there, who did Mood recently, which was amazing. Gemma Chan, who's done a million things, all in these small kind of background roles and things like that. You're like,
I know.
Wow, these are all people that when I watched it the first time round, obviously I didn't know who they were. And then so many people from that show,
absolutely,
not even, obviously including the main cast, have just, gone on to more and more wonderful things.
That was amazing. So I went and did that, and I'd got by that point, I was just like, producers who I'd worked with helped me find an agent. And after Fresh Meat, I didn't do anything for a good few years. I didn't chase it because I just didn't think it was a sustainable. It was nothing that I felt like I could live off. So I thought, well, I've got a full-time job. And then I think a few years later, a script fell on my agent's desk, and it was called Don't Take My Baby, written by Jack Thorne.
Yeah.
And it was a lead, which I'd never experienced auditioning for a lead before. Although I was Mary in my primary school nativity, which I think set me up for life, really. And I read the script and I was like, I will fight people in the street for this role. I have to play this role.
Yeah.
And my agent at the time, she said, if you get this, everything changes. And it did.
Yeah.
And that was when I thought, I have to do this for the rest of my life. But after saying that, I worked constantly after having Don't Take My Baby, but I only quit my full-time job for WizKids in 2019.
It's mad, isn't it?
So I juggled both. I took time off in lieu. I did annual leave. I worked evenings. I did how did I do that now? How did I juggle that? But the bigger the roles got for me, the more I realised, I took a sabbatical when I got Years and Years.
Yeah.
That's how recent it was that
I have. That's mad, isn't it?
Exactly. Because I knew that I had to give my everything to that show because it was such a big thing and it was a big role.
Mm-hmm.
And then whilst I was on the Years and Years, I got a role in The Accident.
Mm.
And so I asked for an extension on my sabbatical. And I remember them saying, I think you're an actor now. And
I think you're leaving. I don't think this is a sabbatical.
It's not a sabbatical anymore, love. But I genuinely have never been more terrified in my life when I said, this is going to be my only source of income. This is how I'm going to pay my mortgage. Was it the right thing to do? Absolutely. 100% the right time. And I've never looked back. Was it the most terrifying thing? Yes, it was the most terrifying thing I've ever done in my life to say, yep, this is my job. And as well, I had a massive, I think we all have it. Of course we do. Massive imposter syndrome. And then it felt really odd for me to, when people say, what do you do for a living? And I say, I'm an actor. It sounded so alien and so weird and uncomfortable.
Yeah.
Because I didn't train. I literally, fell into it in a very different way. But the more I meet people and the more I've kind of become more embedded in the industry, the more I'm fascinated by people's stories about how they got into this. It just, I love it. I love hearing those stories. So
I couldn't relate more on the uncomfortableness and the feeling that it's not, I still have that constant, and it's such a, I honestly think anytime I have to tell someone I'm an actor, it's a trap that's being played on me. Like, because genuinely I'll say, oh, I'm an actor. And again, I don't want to talk about it because I feel so awkward.
Me
and then
too.
They'll push, what have you worked on?
What have I seen you in? I don't know. You
it'll be this. I did this. Oh, who have you worked with? You'll say a name. Oh, name dropping. Like, you've literally forced this out of me. You've forced this out of me. And now you're like, oh, you worked with Tom Hardy, have you? Yeah. I don't want to talk about it. I hate it.
That is exactly how I feel. And you know what? Since I, because I, when acting became, you know, what I was doing in the industry, I didn't write. I've not, writing just kind of went completely, fell by the wayside, because I thought, we'll go back to writing when acting stops, because this is going to be over by tomorrow. So we might as well just enjoy this while it happens. And we can always go back to writing another time. And then the acting just didn't stop. So I, and my agent, who I absolutely love, she's fantastic. She always kept saying to me, she was like, you really should be writing your own stuff now. You can do it. I'm like, no. I did. So when now that whole same thing where the uncomfortable nature of telling people that you're an actor, now I have it again with the whole, when people say, oh, you're a writer. And I go, no.
And that's the weirdest one as well, because with writing, and I've got a load of scripts I'm working on and trying to develop at the moment.
I know.
All of that is purely in your own head.
It
gets made. Until it gets made, again, I generally, exactly the same, I'm not comfortable talking about it because I feel like I'm bullshitting.
That's exactly like the same.
Oh yeah, I'm a script writer. Oh, what have you made?
Well, have you written? Exactly.
I've written loads, but it all goes on behind closed doors, and it's
such a weird thing. And then I think, if I think about it too much, I think, good God, we're in a weird industry. What the hell are we doing?
It's all really odd, mate. It's all really, really strange. And as said, it was a weird jump for me from music in all respects, because in music you do it and then it's out there, whereas even with the acting, you do it and then it's not out for 6 months or
you
a year or whatever
forever.
Else.
Yeah.
And you're like, I'm doing loads of work, but no one knows. And again, I'm not
the type
to be posting online constantly going, oh,
look at me. And oh my God, not at all. So like when people and when other actors say, oh, so what are you working on? You go, don't ask me. I don't like it. It's horrible.
Yeah.
It's a very weird thing. And I think it's always really refreshing to have these conversations, because so often when you're in that imposter syndrome mind, you think everybody else has got their shit together. Everyone knows what they're doing. Everybody is making millions apart from you. And you're just sat here waiting for your stuff to come out that you filmed a year ago. And then the more you actually vocalize it and you have these conversations, you realize no one has a fucking clue what they're doing. We're all just having a bit of a mare, really, but we're also having a great time while we're doing it.
It's beautiful because we've both kind of come from slightly outside of the world.
Yeah.
You still have that outlook of the people on the street. Like, I remember talking to Doc Brown about this. And he was saying, like, he walked down the street and someone was like, you live around here? Why do you live around here? Because he'd just had a film. He was in the Ricky Gervais, David Brent film.
Yeah.
He's like, well, it was one gig. Like, it was a month's work. That's not, I can't then move to somewhere. But like, that's not how this industry works. You could have something huge, but you could then not have anything for a year.
That's what I mean.
For 2 years,
when people,
kind of thing.
And when I'm talking to like young actors who are coming up, they're saying, "Oh, you must not worry at all because you're constantly working." I'm like, for every time you see me on TV, there's like 20 auditions that I didn't get that's gone before that.
And I'm
a lot better now at the rejection side of things, a lot better. Yeah. But I remember at the beginning, I was like, what the fuck am I doing? Why on earth? Who chooses this? And then you realise that the highs are like ridiculously high and there's nothing else on this planet that you want to do. But then you have to be able to mentally handle the really shit parts of it as well, where you might not get a job for God knows how long.
Yeah. I was watching an interview or a clip of an interview recently with Timothy Chalamet. And it's annoying because he's so talented, he's so hot, he's so young, and he's also wise. And he was talking about auditions and saying how he had the big realization that it's all part of the same journey. And most of the big gigs he's had, these huge acting roles, it comes with a producer who worked on something he didn't get, but he made a good impression. He wasn't exactly right for it, but he made a good impression, and he had years of making these good impressions, thinking he was failing and realizing, no, he was those steps. He was climbing.
Absolutely.
And I think that's such an important thing for actors to realise. I was lucky quite early on that I had some casting directors that were, because they knew I'd come from another industry, were really nice and kind of took me under their wing a bit and explained bits like that. That it's like, you're not going to get everything, but it's not because you're shit. And again, I'm lucky, I'm 6'4" and I've got a big beard. I can go, well, I'm not going to be right for everything, am I? So I can kind of...
Well, that's it, exactly.
I can excuse myself a bit. I smashed it, but they probably didn't want a 6'4" guy with a beard, so...
That's how I feel a lot of the time with being in a wheelchair. I was like, okay, yeah, so probably it's not going to work for that role. But,
yeah.
It is definitely... And I've come to really accept that just how many people are going for one role.
Yeah.
There is one space, and how on earth could you ever be expected to be right for everything? That is just crazy. So, I definitely feel as I've moved on in the industry, I've definitely feel like I've accepted and learned so much. Like I've learned more in this industry, I think, than I have ever in my whole life about all manner of things. So yeah, it's just really great to be able to chat those through and share those experiences, because so many people think that the industry is just fun and glamorous. And I'm like, if you think that filming is glamorous, you are very, very wrong.
I got my...
All the stuff afterwards is great. Like the screenings, the premieres, the getting dressed up and sharing your work. That's all glamorous. Actually making the damn thing isn't at all.
My goddaughter is really into drama at school at the moment, and I got her a little part in a small Netflix thing I did recently, and it was 2 days of shooting, and I enjoyed watching, kind of going, this is either going to make you fall in love with it or put you off completely, because it was much just waiting around, much with nothing to do, and then you have a quick go, and the key is that quick go sets your heart on fire. And that's for me. It's like, I'll wait round. I did a feature film a little while back, and they got me in 2 days in a row and didn't get round to shooting my scene.
You've been
But I was allowed to watch. So those were two of the best days I've had. I'm sitting there watching Woody Harrelson and Naomi Harris and people like this, and just like, don't call me. Never call me to set. I'll have 2 weeks of watching you all, and then I'll do my little scene and go home happy.
Exactly. And I think that's one of the joys of our job, is that we get to see such great things happen around us. And it's amazing to even be a small part of that.
Or let's talk a little bit about years and years then, speaking of great things, because Russell T. Davies is an icon. The cast of Russell Tovey, Lydia West, Jessica Hines, Emma Thompson, Rory Kinnear, it was astounding. How was that, number one, to be part of, and then number two, like when it came out? Because it really hit. It really, you know, it really impacted. I know Russell a little bit. My partner still hasn't forgiven him for how much he made her cry in that show, because we had to take a bit of an evening off and pick happy things to watch, because it was incredibly emotional. But what a show to be part of, and what a character as well. I don't want to go back to representation, but representation should be about flawed characters.
Exactly.
Strong characters, just such a variation. And your character in their journey has all of that, is an absolute hero at points, is an absolute villain at points, kind of thing. And
that's the thing. I think one, for me, that Rosie, her, that character for me, and the way Years and Years, just as a show, did that, and the way that Russell and the team created that character, that for me is the benchmark for representation and how it should be done. It Rosie wasn't written as a wheelchair user. She wasn't written as anything in particular. She was a character. And they, I know that, Andy Pryor, fantastic casting team, they saw lots of different people for that character. And what was really interesting is Rose, it wouldn't have made a difference to the story in the sense of there was a lot going on in Years and Years. So the fact that my character ended up as a wheelchair user was kind of pretty low on the excitement scale.
Yeah.
If Rosie had been blind or visually impaired, if she'd been deaf, it wouldn't, if she'd have been an amputee, neurodivergent, it wouldn't have made a difference to the story and what happened. It would have just been a different part of her character, which I found really interesting. Yeah. And when Russell and the team decided that they wanted to cast me, Russell T. Davis and I, we just had a conversation about how much or how little of Rosie's story regarding her disability we would tell and we would share. Again, because, you know, there was a lot going on in Years and Years, and nobody wants to hear the backstory of why Rosie's in a wheelchair. It just became really important.
And no one needs to at
times.
No,
exactly.
Like, how rare I get asked of the backstory of having a beard. But the backstory of having a stammer, you know, it's we need to explain that. That needs
have
to be explained. Well, we don't need to explain
that. No, we don't.
We don't need to, you know.
And that's the great thing. And that, so I remember Russell saying to me, It doesn't feel right or real to ignore it completely because that's weird. But we didn't have on screen a full-blown conversation about it, I think, till at 4. And it was just such a really fantastic way to showcase ambulatory wheelchair users, which I am. And so many times in the past I've been saying, well, maybe you should stay in your wheelchair because we don't want to confuse the audience. And all that stuff, all that bullshit. Whereas this, it was just like, just move how you would move at your own house, in your own house. And so that part of the job was so refreshing and so wonderful. And
it I think it absolutely is the benchmark, as you say, because it's not trying to ignore it completely, but it's not over-explaining it. It's just being complete.
It just is.
Four episodes in is perfect.
Exactly.
Four episodes in to not have mentioned it is it's so good.
And it's just there. But the other side of the job was working with the team that we were with. Like when I knew I'd got the part, I still didn't know who everybody else had was cast. So I found out about a week before, and I was just completely blown away that I would be able to share the screen with these people who I'd watched for years on screen and admired. And it was pretty incredible, and everybody was just divine. They were just heaven to work with. It was such a weird thing because it was the first time I'd worked on an ensemble cast for that long, it was really intense work. And then at the end of the job, you just kind of don't see them for a while. And it was a very strange feeling at the end.
Yeah, it's really odd industry for that, isn't it? Because the nature of getting good performances means you really do have to have these intensely intimate relationships for a limited amount of time. And I know I've spoken to people who've got annoyed because they've felt it feels false that we were best friends a week ago. And now we're not even talking at all. But it is the nature of the industry. And I think
it is.
Because of being a touring musician. And the nature of that is you bump into someone who you haven't seen for 3 years and you're on the road together for a month and you just click back. There's no weirdness or awkwardness. But I can completely understand how people can, particularly in those early jobs, how people can feel a bit used or cast aside. Because again, as you say, you got cast for your next job while on Years and Years. So you, I would imagine, went on to a brand new family straight after that of really beautiful, intense relationships and interactions.
And the thing is, not every job is going to be like that where you make, you know, because different characters, different, you know, parts. It's not always going to be like that, but I think
different kinds of sets as well. The tone on the set can vary massively for good reason. you know?
Absolutely. So I know that if I can take, like, the biggest thing I took away from Years and Years was I know that I could literally go out for a drink with any of that cast.
Yeah.
And just, like you said, just click back in,
yeah,
straight away. And, but also really, like, we're all really supportive, like, of everyone else's job as well. Like, when someone else gets a massive job, it's really exciting. And we, you know, we're all doing the same job. Actors are all doing the same job, and we're, yeah, all just there to champion each other and cheerlead for each other, really.
Yeah. That's the outlook I've connected with people on. It's also an industry that is almost set up to pit us against each other.
Absolutely.
It shouldn't. Every time I've had a good connection on set, it's been with people who were like, oh, how dope is this? This is cool. Oh, you're doing this next. Oh, I know this guy. And we're all pushing in the same direction, rather than, again, absolutely, I completely see how it can be natural to drop into jealousies and things like that. I spoke to a mate of mine recently after he'd got a huge Marvel role. And I said to him, it was beautiful, because I had about 45 minutes of being jealous of him. And I've never had it before. I've always just been, every time he's got anything, I've been like, oh, this is amazing. I had 45 minutes of being jealous of him. And I really quickly realised that it's because I was having a shit week.
Yeah,
so it was purely, exactly, it was nothing to do with our relationship. It was purely, and then it snapped out and it went back to ringing all my mates to say, have you seen what he's got? Have you seen this? This is amazing. So yeah. That's how it's meant to be. There is loads of people going for a limited amount of roles, but that limit is rising because of streaming,
absolutely,
because of our need for content, our hunger for content.
TV, you know, and film, we absorb and we consume programming,
yeah,
completely different now. And, yeah, and it's a really exciting time for actors and creators and writers, any kind of creative who wants to put their work out there. It's like the music industry, isn't it? It's completely different. We consume, yeah, things completely, yeah, differently now. And that's why I think now is the perfect time to increase all sorts of representation. And there's kind of no excuse anymore.
Yeah.
There's no excuse anymore. There's no excuse that's valid anyway.
You touched on Disney earlier because of the thing, and I think they're one of the ones who are really important in representation, and they really try. They don't always get it right, but they really try. And I think that's the kind, yeah, of thing that needs to be applauded. Like, again,
absolutely,
people are going to get it wrong along the way, but Disney and now Marvel and all the things under their bracket, Star Wars, all of that, do push to have a variation of
absolutely
races, genders, abilities all represented in the right way. And as said, part of representation moving at the speeds it needs to move is there's going to be mistakes.
And that's the thing.
People
and
are
going to
get stuff wrong. And it's if they're scared of that, that will move at a snail's pace.
And that's, you know, what I think that there's too much of at the top of the tree is,
yeah,
oh, we can't do that because if we get it wrong, we're going to get sued.
Yeah.
And that's not what it is. It's about it's about opening dialogue and having conversation. And I think that's, yeah, so important, and not being afraid to ask stupid, in inverted commas, questions. It's just really important to be able to have a starting point.
Yeah.
Nothing's going to change if people don't just bite the bullet and just do it.
Stammer are always trying to get across, just give us a ring. I mean, if you're nervous about, because again, it's a tough one, and we've not got time to get into this now, but I don't necessarily believe that all characters who have a stammer have to be played by someone who has a stammer. I think someone who has a stammer should always be seen.
Yep, absolutely, 100%.
It should be a battle, but I want more characters with stammers. It doesn't have to be. But if you're casting somebody who doesn't have a stammer, hit up the professionals to get advice and guidance and stuff,
exactly,
like that. The best example I've seen recently was in Brassic. And the lad who had a stammer in that doesn't have a stammer in real life, but he got coached by one of the people who works at Stammer. And really, it showed. I was just watching the show and I was like, oh shit, have they cast a guy who's got a stammer? And then it turns out he hasn't. It's like, well, that means they've done it right then. They've done it well. It's not going like the old characters who have stammer. I was going to do bad impressions then, but it's too
demeaning. I was going to say,
we can leave it there.
We don't need to go there. We don't need to go there.
But I'm conscious of your time, so I want to wrap things up. And I just want to ask what is ahead? Because on my notes was, when are you going to be doing more writing, and when are we going to see stuff that you've created? And you've already touched upon that, obviously being, you know, part of a focus. So
absolutely. So probably since lockdown, I actually thought, okay, so I actually should put my degree to good use now. Yeah. Now is the perfect time.
Yeah.
I have found it the most challenging,
yeah,
wonderful, mm-hmm, torturous, but joyful thing. It's a completely different discipline.
Yeah.
And I am easily distracted as an
actor. I
was
going to say, it's an individual discipline as well, though, because you
that's
can't
what
just...
I mean.
Someone can tell you how they do it, and it's
oh
not going to work
God.
For you.
It's, and yeah. also, you'll have days where you just can't do it. You'll have days yeah. where you're just like, my brain just won't operate today in the way I need it to be able to create something decent.
I booked a week away to get writing done once, and I got about 4 pages done,
yep.
and I was fuming. Yep. The day I got back,
you finished
I
it.
Wrote about 30 pages. Yeah, I literally, yeah. I stormed through it, because part of that week away was allowing myself, right, forget the pressure of it, let the ideas move around in your brain. I'd walk around, I'd go to cinemas, but I'd made that conscious switch to being in the mode of that story. So even if I wasn't getting it on paper,
it doesn't matter.
It was all moving, and yeah, it's a weird
one. And I have found it really challenging to yeah. be able to, like, I'm a social nightmare, so I'm like, let's go do this. Should we go and do this? Should we go and have coffee and stuff, when I know I should be writing?
Yeah.
So to lock myself away in my office and sit and write sounded at the beginning incredibly terrifying and hideous. But I have absolutely loved the whole process of learning how to develop a script, learning how to develop characters, learning how to redraft, learning how to take notes from your commissioner, all of those different things. It's a different thing. But at the same time, I know, I truly do feel that being an actor makes me a better writer. And I yeah. do think being a writer makes me a better actor. So yeah. because you, as actors, we know what is shit dialogue. So we're never going to write shit dialogue.
Yeah, yeah,
so it's...
we've had to say shit dialogue.
Exactly.
We don't want to put someone through that.
Exactly, exactly. So yeah, it's a fantastic thing to say that I'm doing, and I am at that is actually at the minute that is the body of my work, which is I'm learning about all sorts of the pressures of deadlines when I have writer's block and all of that excitement. Mm-hmm. I went through a phase a few weeks ago of apparently only being productive at 1 o'clock in the morning till like 4. Who knew? I was the weirdest things ever. Like I got up yesterday on a Sunday of all times, and I was like, I know what I need to write. I've got this really good thing, and I'm sat there on a Sunday. I'm like, what are you doing, you lunatic? But I've learned that it comes when it comes, and if it's not going to come, there's no point in sitting there trying to force it out, because if you're in that kind of headspace, whatever comes out is going to be shit anyway. So yeah, that's pretty much the stuff that I'm doing. I just we're on the edge now. Fingers crossed. Heading towards that green light, I'm keeping everything crossed, but it's a fantastic learning experience, fantastic, and I'm really, really excited to share stuff. I'm excited now. If it happens, I will literally go into hiding and never come out until,
of course,
it's done
as it should be.
Of course, why on earth would I want to enjoy that part? But it's it's great. So that's what I have been focusing on a lot of. I've done a lot of filming this year, which is exciting too, that, you know, isn't going to come out till God knows when. So when it comes out, I'll be able to talk about it.
Yeah.
So, I'm very lucky that I've been kept very busy, and I'm very excited to see what next year has in store.
I love it. I can't wait to see all that's ahead. And I really appreciate you taking the time. I was really pleased that we could line this up. And,
me
yeah,
too, mate. Thank you so much for asking me. I was so excited. I love your stuff. So, and I love your podcast. So when you asked, I was like, yes, please.
Let's do that. Well, that's perfect. Well, I'm going to press stop.
Oh, it's been awesome. I'm going to press stop on mine too.
It's been an absolute joy.
You've been listening to Scroobius Pip's Distraction Pieces.
There we go. That was Roof. How wonderful is Roof? A day or two after this was recorded, my partner B, who's been a creator in residence at the BBC, was at a speech that was being given by Russell T. Davis. And I was like, if you get a chance to talk to him, tell him how amazing. Tell him about the conversation me and Roof have had that isn't available yet, but about how he managed to pull off the perfect representation. I mean, we've talked about it all there. I think that was too much for B to try and get in. I think they just had a chat and were excited. So that was lovely. But yeah, what a legend that man is. And what a legend Roof is. And what a legend Lenny Rush is. Tune in on Friday. Honestly, you're going to love this conversation. It's a slightly shorter one than normal, but it's a really strong one. And Lenny's just astounding. Only the second 12 or 13 year old I had on. I had my goddaughter on in the Where's Your Head At series as we were coming out of lockdowns. But yeah, it's a really good chat. I think you're going to enjoy it. So I'll see you on Friday. Until then, stay safe and stay sane. Ta-ta.
Even when we're on a budget, we still deserve nice things. Quince is a place to scoop up stunning high-end goods for 50 to 80% less than similar brands. They have buttery soft cashmere sweaters starting at $50, luxurious Italian leather bags, and so much more. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get the high-end goods you'll love without the high price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/style for free shipping and 365-day returns.